Hello, OTM listeners. Producer Leia Fetter here. Last week, the MacArthur Foundation awarded their so-called genius grants to 25 thinkers in literature, music, science, and the arts. One of the recipients was Rutgers professor and writer John Keane, who is recognized for his valuable work, quote, exploring the impact of historical narratives on contemporary lives and reimagining the history of the Americas from the perspective of suppressed voices. Back in 2015, Brooks spoke to Keane about his book Counter-Narratives. And this week, in light of his recent recognition, we're bringing you that conversation. It's one of our favorites from the archive. Here's Brooke.
Keane conjures the voices of people at the margins of history and puts them at the center. History never happens in isolation, says Keane. Every story has a twin.
I was very interested in histories that are totally hidden, totally buried, totally obscured. Counter-narratives are working against historical master narratives, and they play overtly with the writing of history.
Keane locates these twin stories in the tale of a slave who blithely disregards his constraints, in the spiritual and sexual union of two poets during the Harlem Renaissance, in the experiences that motivate an African dictator's nihilistic brutality. Keane is always challenging our assumptions. His characters are not acted upon or only acted upon. They are the actors. They choose to flee or fight or even in one story to very nearly fly.
So in Acrobatique, a real historical figure that we've really never ever heard from, Miss Lala, the subject of Edgar Degas' famous painting, actually gets to describe her initial encounter with the person who memorialized her.
And we get to encounter her.
Exactly.
The painting is Degas' 1879 work titled Miss Lala at the Cirque Fernando. You've probably seen his rendering of a small, strong young woman suspended high in the atrium of the Parisian circus by a rope between her teeth. For 136 years, she's been frozen in that moment, silenced by the rope. But Keane puts us inside the head of Miss Lala, a.k.a. Anna Olga Albertina Brown, or in reference to her mixed race, Olga the Negress, the Venus of the tropics, the African princess.
Imagine this woman in the late 19th century who really was so extraordinary. She was such a superstar all over Europe. And she's captured in this iconic painting. And many people know of the painting, but almost no one asked the question, who was Miss Lala? The entire story is one continuous sentence. Here, Miss Lala is actually talking about letters that she writes back to her family.
Letters of a life so foreign, so exalted and dangerous for her and her performance partner, her family can't really respond.
And we prayed like Catholic girls to the saints that there would be no accident. There wasn't, though their letters in return never mentioned those bits, nor did they repeat a single word about all the other things. How I intend to spend every waking hour in the air, to soar with the brio of a sparhawk, and glide with a sparrow's ease, and float, as Kyra and I do, as the audience perches on the tips of their seats with the lightness of two creatures who have fully emerged from the chrysalis. How I want to suspend the entire city of Paris, or even France itself, from my lips. How I aim to exceed every limit placed on me, unless I place it there. Because that is what I think of when I think of freedom. That I have gathered around me people who understand how to translate fear into possibility, who have no wings but fly beyond the most fantastical vision of the clouds, who face death daily back out into the waiting room. And I am one of them.
probably Keene's most talked about story, is rivers, because we all have such a strong identification with its twin. It's the personal story of Jim Watson, the escaped slave from Mark Twain's The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn.
Reading this story as a young African-American junior high and then high school student was a somewhat traumatic experience. I loved the story, but I was also deeply disturbed by the story. And it was very difficult to come to terms with until I was much older, and then I was able to really appreciate what Mark Twain was doing. But I was always fascinated by Jim and Jim's life because he's so integral to Huck's experience, and yet we learn so little about him.
In Rivers, Jim, here called Jim Rivers, is interviewed by a journalist who wants his take on the events in Twain's novel. The story begins with Jim thinking what he doesn't want to talk to the reporter about, the two times he's seen Huck since the events of Twain's book. Once again, we are in the head of a character who we know, but never really knew.
Of course, the sort of natural inclination would be to focus on Huck and Tom Sawyer. And so I thought, how could I tell a story in which someone wants Jim to tell that story, but he tells another story, which would have been the story of my, I guess, great-great-grandparents or people like them living in places like Missouri, the Upper South. So all those things did kind of fit together.
Mm-hmm.
And then I bring Huck and Tom Sawyer back.
Jim encounters Huck and Tom long after the events on the river. As Jim considers what he isn't going to tell Tom and Huck, we're hearing what's going on in his head.
I think to conclude to the Sawyer boy and Huckleberry that I keep that certificate at all times and in all places against my chest in a leather pouch I bought for myself. And it reads, James Alton Rivers, free person of color, a resident or citizen of the state of Illinois, at all times and all places, and entitled to be respected accordingly, in person and property, at all times and all places, signed with the seal of said court at Chicago on the 23rd of November in the year of our Lord 1852. And I have carried it all the way up to and through the time I returned to Missouri, settling here in St. Louis, since I was not ever going to set feet again in Hannibal if I could help it. And even when some of the Hannibal people, including the LaFleurs, have happened upon me down here, there's not a thing they could say or do because I had the states of Missouri, Illinois, and the federal government on my side. Though I've always made sure to have an escape route and a safe house on the other side of the river ready to flee to, given the trials the courts are putting Mr. Dredd and Mrs. Lizzie Scott through. Instead, I said, I was living in Chicago for a few years. Then I decided to come back home. I posted my bond to stay here, have been working steadily, and decided to settle down. Chicago, Sawyer said, looking at Huckleberry. Some go to Chicago and get ideas. The angles of that face, like broken porcelain, pulled apart and recombined until I almost didn't recognize him. Well, sounds to me like Jim is keeping himself out of trouble. And the worst thing for anybody these days is getting caught up in all that trouble. Getting involved with people like Lovejoy or Tory, or that new agitator writer, Mrs. Stowe, what likes to stir up a whole heap of trouble, too.
Keene's counter-narratives take many forms. Some are told through diaries or letters or spoken dialogues or internal monologues. One story unfolds as a 72-page footnote to a fictional encyclopedia. In the piece called Persons and Places, Keene presents two narrations side by side. On the left, the very young W.E.B. Du Bois, who would become a renowned intellectual and activist. And on the right, his Harvard instructor, George Santayana, the influential Spanish philosopher.
I was very interested in thinking about the relationship between these two very, very important figures. Du Bois was a student of Santayana, and in some of the biographies of Du Bois, and also in Du Bois's writing, he talks about studying with Santayana because it was a big deal, because Santayana was a major figure in American philosophy. In a really strange and enchanting memoir that Santayana wrote called Persons and Places, he talks about his time at Harvard and mentions many students, but strangely, he does not mention the student who, first of all, would have stood out just physically, but also who went on to become one of the major figures of his time. So I thought, what might that first encounter between these two people look like?
In this excerpt, Du Bois speaks first, then Santayana. Each describes passing the other on a chilly autumn afternoon in Harvard Square.
Why does he glower so? Is it fear? For certainly he has seen a Negro before. Or can it be an acknowledgement of how deeply we are linked? Or does he, like nearly all the rest of them, not really see me at all? Of course there will be scant possibility of a friendship, be he a Latin or the Statue of Liberty, for even Professor William James, in all his eccentric allegiance, admits, when we are at the same table, of all those unshakable walls that separate us. Still, I know that at some point soon, I shall have the opportunity to probe his mind, share my inquiries. He and I alone, in an upper room, and he will come to appreciate our common humanity.
This jeune philosophe, like the other Negro students, the handful of unassimilable Easterners, Chinese, Mexican boys, must by necessity subsist on an island even more remote than that on which I sojourned during my college days within this larger crimson archipelago. At one level, I imagine it would provide a place of refuge and some element of happiness for their small and scorned society. He observes me as if he has already examined the catalog of ideas and impressions which I shall tell him when we eventually speak, of the gulf between the true self and the world outside and how the mind, through its exercises, bridges it, of the importance of doubt in the philosophical method, of those fugitive joys and sincere ecstasies, that heaven that lies in the heart of the earth, of my own long and unfolding exile.
Keane wanted to have Du Bois and Santayana talking to each other,
but not exactly hearing each other. So the columns don't touch, and yet they're side by side. So there is this sense of connection and contiguity. These lives are unfolding in parallel. They are, like the columns, looking at each other, but they have not yet found the language to speak to each other.
I'm wondering how you view the role of fiction here. In counter-narratives, it seems to function as a kind of antidote to history, a way to rebuke it or correct it through the poetic imagination.
Fiction, I believe, has tremendous empathic power. Some of the most recent studies in neuroaesthetics are showing this. In psychology and cognitive studies are showing us the power of fiction and narrative in general to shape our perceptions. Stories offer us a way to enter other bodies, other spaces, and help transform our own perspectives.
I know you wrote your own memoir of growing up in St. Louis. You have written the memoirs of people who never existed. It's almost as if the twin to their story in one sense is your own.
Exactly. In my first book, Annotations, which is a memoir, it's also a novel, it could be read as a long poem, it's sort of a hybrid of all these different genres. It was very much about my own experience, about the experiences of people my age, a little older, a little younger, growing up at a particular time, at a particular place, particularly Black, and in my case, queer, but many people have told me after reading it that it resonates for them, even though their personal experiences were very different. With this book, I wanted to step outside myself and to really think more broadly about the people who came before me, before us, and to try to tell their stories. And so I saw that as a deeply ethical act, and I hope that I've done all of them justice.
John Keane's act is an elegant reminder of the countless hidden histories yet to be uncovered, as well as those we still choose to ignore. Maybe that's what the fiction and counter-narratives can encourage us to do, to seek out these kinds of stories, so they don't have to exist solely in our imagination.
Speaking of what exists in our imagination, this week we're diving into the elusive, slippery world of money. How we attach value to paper and coin, and how that faith, sometimes blind, sometimes fickle, shapes our world.
I like to joke that, you know, in the beginning was not the coin, in the beginning was the receipt.
There's nothing inherently valuable about a dollar bill or a coin that you keep in your pocket or even a bar of gold.
The waitress came over and said the drawing looked like a $1 bill and asked if she could buy it from me.
Bitcoin, the virtual currency that doesn't abide by rules of a bank or government.
Let's think about the whole crypto thing. So I've spent a lot of time thinking about this, reading about this, and taking it very seriously. And I've come to the following conclusion. If you have to explain to someone it's money, it's not money.
Is he right about that? Look for our special episode called Full Faith and Credit on this feed or wherever you get your podcasts. And thanks.